All right, welcome back now to Driving in Your Car Talk Radio, getting mad at things. We got a whole list of things to be mad at today, folks, but first up, we got a very special guest. This is a little bit of a kooky one. We've got Emily Lowen, leader of the BC Green Party. She's promising a whole raft of new spending here in BC. She wants to be soft on crime, shut down our energy infrastructure, decriminalize drug use inside schools and kindergartens, bring back the carbon tax at a higher rate, slow down our infrastructure, and tax your hardworking revenue. Emily, thank you for being here.
Quite the intro. Great to be here, Mike.
Now, we got a huge budget deficit under the far left-wing BC NDP government with David Eby. He is a maniac of wokeness. And you want to go even further, some kind of a utopian unicorn kind of rainbow thing. My first question here, a lot of people are asking, do you know what economics are and how are you going to pay for it? Are you going to be going into these billionaires' homes, stripping the stuff off the walls and selling it on the street corner?
No. So the reality is, BC billionaires are not paying their fair share. We look back, you know, Gordon Campbell in the early 2000s slashed tax rates primarily for the 1% and the largest corporations. And the BC NDP just hasn't had the courage to reverse any of those policies. Our corporate tax rate is lower than it was in 2005, for instance. So we've been limping along with this hollowed out tax system for decades. So it looks like reversing some of those changes, but also targeting BC's richest. So I'm looking at a one-time 10% tax on wealth over $100 million in BC. That means that only 600 households with that tax alone would shore up $13 billion. That's enough to pay for universal childcare, fast and free transit, and social housing at scale.
All right, I can see the boards lighting up already. You've really angered our listeners. They are just fuming, spitting mad on the lines already. They want more belt tightening and cuts, and you're talking about the opposite. Good luck with that. Now, you're advocating for something called proportional representation. What the heck is that, and how is it going to destroy our economy?
Proportional representation means that the number of seats a party gets matches the number of people who actually voted for you. This would mean that no matter what party you're voting for, that shows up in actual representation in the legislature. I think a lot of people, when they go to the polls, it feels like they're wasting their vote or they're stuck between two choices, between lesser evils. So this, for me, proportional representation is a move to reinstilling democracy and ensuring that everyone feels like their vote counts. And it won't destroy the economy.
Callers, the lines are lighting up right now. They are crashing cars. They are pulling over on the way to work. So mad in their cars. I guess my next question is, for all of the hardworking people in this province who go to work pumping oil out of the ground, mining things, cutting down trees, and putting boots on necks, how are you going to win those votes when you're talking like, and I'll just be frank here, a circus clown?
So I would say to those workers in extractive industries that we collectively need to chart out a long-term vision of those industries. And, you know, in the case of forestry, in the case of many industries, it's the CEOs who are trying to automate those jobs out of existence and reduce the amount of workers on the ground. I think we need to be shifting industries so that they are diverse, value-added, and actually require more labor in the case of forestry, for example. So, you know, what's good for CEOs is rarely good for the workers of the industry. So I'm here to challenge those foreign multinational CEOs that are really stripping our province and running away with the profits.
Zany, kooky stuff. Doesn't really make sense to me. Clearly got a hateful heart. Part of a plan to break into your home, take the food out of your children's mouth, and make sure that they are crying every night when you're trying to sleep. But before you can respond to that, Emily, we're going to go to the lines with our first caller, Jeremy in Vancouver. You have the line.
I'm crashing my car. I don't know what I'm doing.
All right, Jeremy, we need you to calm down. There's other drivers on the road.
How are you going to make my gas cheaper?
energy is at the heart of everything. And I think the war in Iran has revealed that our fossil fuel economy is really at the whims of global oligarchs like Trump, who get to inflict these illegal wars and make the cost of our gas, our groceries, our housing go up. And so we need a way to establish actual energy security, things that allow us to reduce our heating bills, things like heat pumps and renewable energy.
Hey, Jeremy, what do you think about that?
I heard a lot of things, but I didn't hear cheap gas.
You know, we actually want to make these profiteering oil and gas companies pay. Right now, they're making massive profits, billions and billions on the war in Iran. That is part of the reason why your gas prices are rapidly increasing. So we want them to pay a windfall tax and use that money to make your life more affordable.
Jeremy, are you there? I heard that. No. Now, I think Jeremy's crashed his car in anger and possibly died. Thank you very much, Emily Lowen, leader of the BC Green Party, for that. You've just taken one of our hardworking workers out of the economy. And more of that to come. Next on the line, Dan in North Vancouver, you're on the line.
So absolutely furious. I don't know why I decided to start driving after I became upset. I managed to enter an extremely busy thoroughfare.
Thoroughfare? Dan went to college.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I'm actually not angry at all. These things make a lot of sense to me. But for some reason, I found it really hard to call in. Not to be conspiratorial, but I think that there's like a whole group of these guys who get paid by...
We're going to turn up that this guy... Now, we've dealt with this guy before. He's a troll. He's sick in the head. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He agrees with things which are crazy. And I will not be giving Emily a chance to respond to that one. But next up on the line, one more caller. This is Jim in Richmond. You're on the line, Jim. Do you agree with me, the host, or are you bananas kooky?
I don't know. That stuff really makes sense to me, too.
All right, we're getting off. Many people have gotten too angry. They've crashed their car.
No, I'm not angry at all. I'm actually quite supportive of these policies. It's a refreshing thing to have someone in politics speaking values, you know, that I actually espouse myself.
Oh, all
it's
right.
Been really good.
Thank you for thank you for your time. That's all the time we have for you. What do you think? Y'all call us, text us. In what way is this infeasible, crazy, or violent? After the break, we're going to be talking to a LNG lobbyist about the new LNG plant, but in the guise that they are a private citizen. Stay with us, and special thanks to our sponsor. I think it's called like Our House Design Build or something like that. They say it all the time. It's some sort of like renovation thing. I hear it every day when I... Anyways, that's the end of the sketch.
Shout out to Our House Design Build.
You're keeping our lights on over here by getting people to flip their houses and make property values go up, which we all like as homeowners and car drivers. After the break. Everybody, and welcome back to the Seriously Wrong podcast. We are your co-hosts as usual, Sean and Aaron. This voice is Sean and that voice is Aaron.
Hi, everybody.
That voice. And today we are joined by Emily Lowen, the leader of the BC Green Party. Thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here.
And we're also joined by Daniel Horan Greenford, who's a postdoc in ecological economics, researching energy transitions and wealth inequality. A policy contributor to the BC Green Party who helped write the wealth tax proposal. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Emily, you've been leader of the BC Greens for about 7 months now. It's an interesting time for you, I'm sure. How did you become leader of the BC Green Party?
That is a great question. It was an email that I almost deleted because I thought it was spam. So the Green Party emailed me and The title was something kind of wacky, I'll say it. It was like Legacy, Talent, and Purpose, Job Opportunity. And you usually delete these kind of emails. You think they're spam, but it was just an off chance day about a year ago that I opened it. And I just got fixated about the potential of this party. They had had a rough election. Everyone I tried to convince to do this job instead of me said, hey, you know, the party's pretty anemic. You know, I think they're kind of a mess. And I was like, I think there's something that can be done here. And I think that we've seen the BCNDP categorically abandon their traditional progressive and labor base. I think this year, especially looking at the decriminalization pilot, looking at the rapid expansion of liquefied natural gas and US-owned fossil fuel exports, looking at indigenous rights and labor rights across the board with the longest running strike in BC's public service history. And so it was clear to me that we needed a strong voice on the eco-socialist left to really build a thriving movement. And yeah, I'll just say that I got fixated on this idea, tried to get a bunch of other people to do it, and here I am. We launched into this pretty quickly. I built my campaign team in the span of 3 weeks, launched into the world, and it was pretty remarkable. We were able to double the base of the BC Green Party within 5 weeks of our membership drive. And many of those people were young folks under the age of 30. So we're seeing a lot of rising momentum on a lot of these fronts. But yeah, all to say that I didn't expect to be here. This was not on my bingo card for this year, but I'm kind of thriving. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting how, like, yeah, you mentioned the BC Greens being pretty anemic and people using that as a reason to be like, yeah, you know, I don't know, maybe they're just kind of dead in the water. But it goes to show that you can inject energy into organizations like that. You know, the BC Greens don't feel anemic right now.
Great. Goal one accomplished. Yeah.
I saw a poll recently that looked pretty good for the Green Party. Since you become leader, Green Party is going up in the polls. I would expect that during the leadership race, when you have a candidate who's on the hard left, the common sense would be like, oh, well, it sounds good and we secretly support it, but we can't actually put that person forward because it's not going to be successful with the electorate. But it looks like the opposite is happening.
I think so. It's almost like being uncompromisingly progressive and sticking to your values and being authentic appeals to people. The most recent poll has us up 8 points and the establishment parties respectively down 7 or 11 points. So it's clear that people want to see bold politics in practice and a real workers' party. And seeing the BCNDP pick their path. They had a near-death experience in the last election. And instead of working on things that are going to actually materially improve working people's lives and prevent the rise of this sort of far-right culture war movement, they chose to just chase the polls and chase center-right voters. There's a lot to complain about, but I think more than anything, people want to see a party with real positivity and solutions and energy behind it.
Yeah, it seems like there's a little bit of a global thing happening right now with these populist left parties, but not just populist, but like a sort of an informed populism. Like looking at BC Green Communications, it's kind of like high information stuff. Like there's educational resources going out in the communication at the same time, but it's also rooted in a very like guttural place of populism has enemies and people on side, and it has high stakes and it has an emotional component to it. And you could see that with Zoran Mondani's campaign or Zach Polensky in the UK and Sean Orr in Vancouver. Shout out Sean. Seeing in the communications that the BC Greens have been doing, I think there was an Epstein connection made in one of these videos to an LNG plant. And I was like, okay, they're doing real politics here. This is awesome. Yeah. This is going to work. That's exactly like door knocking with left-wing parties and talking to voters who are across the spectrum. There's a consensus on Epstein.
Yep. So I feel like I had to learn this lesson the hard way. I was politicized when I was about 16. During Trump's first election in 2016. And that sort of plunged me into the climate movement. I was really politicized by the existential nature of the climate crisis and got involved in the global climate strike movement and divestment campaigns and worked in civil society for 3 years after my degree. And I think I did really have to learn that the left has a real issue with pummeling people with emotionless information. And it's so holier than thou. And it's like, it's not positioning ourselves well. And we can get so caught up in these sort of purity politics and identity politics when the right is just outflanking us completely on affect, on emotional affect, and tapping into people's real economic anxieties, but pairing that with all the false solutions. So we saw this, this is really when this lesson landed for me, was when Pierre Poilievre was able to storm the country. And if Trump had not come up at that time, he would have won the election on an axe the tax election. That was his plan, right? That's not going to make anyone's grocery bills lower. That's not going to solve our problems. But it just showed to me that we do need to see that kind of relentless attention to people's material working conditions and acknowledging the emotional reality of people's day-to-day existence. I think what the BCNDP and what the Liberals do is continuously just try to convince people that their lives aren't that bad. Oh, we have these statistics that your rent is down 0.02% or whatever it is. Stop complaining. That is what opens the door to fascism. That kind of, I don't know, paternalistic, condescending approach is what breeds these far-right movements. And I think the stakes are high and are incredibly high here in BC, because that's nearly what lost the NDP the last election. Rustad was really taking that approach. He was actively catalyzing the anger and the upset amongst working people with obviously all the wrong solutions. And now we see OneBC polling at 11% with actively genocidal policy and are completely racist top to bottom. So yeah, it's a really important time to, you know, grow this movement provincially, but also look at what's happening globally. And I think this is such a global trend, from Zohran Mamdani to Zach Polansky leading the UK Greens to Chloe Swarbrick in the New Zealand Greens. I think there's a real resurgence of eco-socialist politics. And I think it's the only way that we can defeat the far right.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That kind of like liberal institutional form of politics isn't prepared to address that type of sentiment out with the public, because like you're saying, like the business as usual, everything is going fine kind of thing. It's something about being in these institutions too. People get hypnotized by it. I'm part of the parliament. I have to defend the parliament's structure and history and stuff. And it, like, you see that psychologically happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it, because of that conventional wisdom that like, oh, you're going to put people off by being too left-wing, too bold in these ideas, and leadership is saying like everything's fine and oh, we need to maybe make a few small changes here and there. It just completely sucks all the air out of the room. It demotivates people who actually care about things and makes you feel like nothing can happen. Then when someone like, yeah, Trump shows up, I think there's an impulse to be like, well, you know, whatever, anything, let's just do something different from what's going on now. He seems like an outsider. Mm-hmm. There's an energy that is captured there. And for better or worse, like all these extreme right-wing parties that rose up after Trump have made people feel like, oh, like some really different shit can happen and it could be really, really bad. But there's also possibilities for it being really good.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. And we see this in the numbers as well, with Bernie and AOC's supporters are also Trump supporters, which seems hypocritical or inconsistent, but there is a real anti-establishment logic there. And the promise of actually fighting for working people, obviously Trump is not doing that. But yeah, I think it's really important to, as the left, be relentlessly focused on improving people's material conditions. And with the BC Greens, that looks like fast free transit. It looks like massively scaled social housing and free childcare. And we're going to pay for it with a wealth tax. Because I think there should be a common sense And it's been beaten out of us so aggressively, but that, you know, BC is a beautiful province and we are surrounded by so much wealth. You walk around downtown Vancouver and you're lapped by Bugattis, and there's just this deep sense of wealth inequality. And I think it's so important to tax wealth specifically, not just income, not just raising the income brackets, because we know that the ultra wealthy don't make their money the normal way. It is passively accumulated through real estate trusts and massive sort of industrial exploitation. And all to say that I think it's so important that the left here in BC follows in the footsteps of what we see in New York City and the UK Greens, because it's winning electorally. My favorite example from the UK Greens is their by-election win in Denton. It's a riding that they should have never won. It's, by all sort of pundit assumptions and some polling, it was looking like a really tight three-way race, even with the recent surge behind the Greens. And they comfortably won it. They took that seat because they were so focused on tackling wealth inequality and actual solutions. And so that's really the only way that we're able to break through the establishment parties dividing people and focusing on culture war issues.
Yeah, the stakes came up in both the rise of fascism and also what comes to mind with the Green Party is we have this ecological crisis, which is people are talking about it a little less than they used to, but I don't think it's because it got better. I think we're still, that still might be an issue. So yeah, I'm curious, Daniel, if you could help express to us these existential stakes that we have with the climate crisis and how it relates to inequality.
I don't think the climate crisis or ecological crisis writ large has gotten any better. It's gotten worse, but we're talking about it less because people's lives are getting worse. And there's only so much quote unquote bandwidth, not to use a word that we're adopting from the machine world. I always hear Bookchin in the back of my head when I say feedback or bandwidth, and he's like, just stop. So you can't, you speak like a human, not a machine.
Organic, yeah. Ecological metaphors. Yeah.
Yeah.
We need better ones. I just don't have one for bandwidth. So the left, the onus is on the left or some progressive populist front to reimagine what climate policy looks like. And the thing is, it's actually not very hard. The goals actually align quite well. Wealth redistribution is a climate policy. The people at the top, by dint of their personal consumption, their luxury travel emissions for one, is huge. 1% of people on the planet actually account for over half of the amount of travel by air. And then also their investments and outsized control they have over the economy and how they chase the most lucrative things in the short term, which often actually are fossil fuel powered, be it infrastructure or even worse, things that degrade the fabric of our society, like pursuing forever wars. I was a researcher on Carbon Inequality Kills report by Oxfam. We put together a sample of 50 billionaires and their luxury travel emissions and their investment emissions. And we found that quite astonishingly, if everybody on the planet emitted the same way as the top 50 billionaires, we'd finish our remaining carbon budget under 1.5 within a matter of hours. The top 1% by income, if everyone on the planet emitted like them, we'd exhaust the remaining carbon budget within a matter of months. Essentially, at the top, it's an outsized amount of aviation. It's not a personal consumption problem. It's a systemic problem of how we live. And travel is a big part of that. And a lot of these travel emissions could be avoided or decarbonized. If we actually took control back and redistributed wealth from the top, curbing their emissions personally, substantially, and also taking back our economic productivity, we would be solving these two problems at the same time.
Yeah, and that's why I ran under the slogan of fight the oligarchs, fund our future. Even if people suddenly cared about climate, even if people were to form a mass movement around climate instantaneously and force all of the pressure in the world, what we hear from this provincial government is that the cupboard is bare, right? Like, we are staunchly in this austerity frame, as we've seen with the most recent provincial budget. And here in BC, we don't have a spending problem, we have a revenue problem. And how we tackle that is by tackling wealth inequality to fund things that are climate programs, transit is a climate program. Social housing with heat pumps is a climate program. Good union jobs, green jobs is a climate program. So I think it's about changing the strategy, changing the way we communicate on climate to meet people where we're at. Instead of really front-loading climate jargon and like emissions necessarily, we need to be addressing the cost of living crisis in a way that redistributes wealth, power, and resources and benefits working people the most. And that will lower our emissions.
Yeah, part of the kind of inherited frame, and it comes from that institutional politics thing as well, too, I think, is like when we had these waves of increased interest in climate over the last couple decades, that a lot of the policies that were implemented, they're always these very technocratic half measures, and they were always targeted.
I wonder why.
Exactly. Affecting the regular people. It's your guilt. Everyone's guilty of this. Everyone did the climate crisis.
Yeah.
There's no difference between the CEO of ExxonMobil and a poor kid on reserve. Everyone fucked it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we expect you to change, asshole. And like that registered emotionally with people in a way like the plastic straw versus paper straw thing. And then your straw is soggy and you're like, these activists ruined my latte or my iced tea. Yeah. But that's, I don't know all the details, but it seems like it's probably a positive thing. But at the same time, it was like never the point. That was never the nexus of a climate transition, is we're going to stop using plastic in our straws in particular. Like what we're talking about, I'm really interested in this, is the places where climate policy is actually making regular people's lives better, where it's like it's an offer to them. And free transit, I think, is one of the best examples of that. It's like you can imagine if there's fast, free, reliable, rapid transit around where you can make the choice to take a bus instead of driving and you're not going to have a worse experience as a result. Like that's a good value offer for people. And yeah, I feel like broadly the left has made good progress in this. And like part of it is the liberals retreating from climate. And so there's a lot more space for us to be like, let's do some real shit.
One of the biggest pitfalls of the last decade is the narrative has been so absorbed by green capitalism, touted by liberals and NGOs. And it's so deflating to these movements of what climate policy could actually look like from a workers and a working class perspective. And I think that's honestly how the Green Party lost momentum to a degree, is because we were painted with that Tories and Teslas brush. And it's really important that we seize the opportunity now to have a clear program, actually act on fast free transit and green social housing and good jobs.
Yeah, because so much of the climate stuff is about infrastructure, and it's like you can tell people to take shorter showers or not drive so much, or it's bad to take a plane all you want. But yeah, you need options for how are you going to transit otherwise. You need the infrastructure to actually exist. And then, yeah, there's the benefit of building all this infrastructure. You get jobs, that kind of stuff.
The left's not asking people to lower global emissions through their personal choices. The left is asking governments to actually be courageous enough to take money from the tippy top, use that to finance programs that will actually materially change the world we live in so that people can make choices that make their lives easier and cheaper. And I think that when we frame things in the way that most emissions come from the top and most money is being hoovered up and or siphoned up to the top, these put blame on the wealthiest individuals. And of course, even if the top 50 billionaires disappeared overnight somehow, I'm not sure how that would happen. I'm not suggesting anything in particular for the record, but there's still everyone else. And of course, like, it's a collective problem. The point of the Oxfam Carbon Inequality Kills report is to show the absurdity of the super rich and how they're not like us. They're not like our normal humans living in the mire, floundering in our own waste. It's like, they're a different breed and they see themselves as such, but we need to raise revenue. And so to do that, there's a lot of money in BC and a lot of it's absurdly concentrated. So we can take that and use that to finance things rather than promise them an abstract option that doesn't exist, which is often what happens with the left. Like, oh, here's like a video of like wind turbines and rapid transit and stuff, but you're still stuck in a suburb with a car. And then you're just like, I'm not going to vote for this. You haven't shown me that you're even doing anything to materialize these options. So the onus is on us to actually make these options available to people.
So with Fight the Oligarchs Fund Our Future, part of that means exactly what we've been saying is that we need to tax the very tippiest top of our economy to deliver on these climate and affordability programs. But it also means that we need to tackle the corporate capture in our government that shapes policy in this direction. It also means breaking up the monopolies that have been allowed to fester across BC's economy. People like Jim Pattison, who's one of the richest men in our province with a $13 billion net worth, he doubled that net worth by price gouging people during the first year of COVID. And I think most of us are still trying to financially recover from COVID. And so Jim Pattison, by going on these sort of feverish acquisition rampages throughout his whole career, he's able to own so much of our resources in terms of forestry, ads and media, fish licenses, Canada's largest coal terminal. That kind of monopoly control is also antithetical to climate action, in my view. And we need to break up that kind of monopoly control in order to really support small and medium businesses, the kind of decentralized economy that an energy transition necessitates. Because that's one of the bigger energy and policy shifts that we see is that instead of focusing on mega projects like foreign-owned LNG exports, where we're ripping and shipping our resources abroad, hoping to make a buck in 5 or 10 years, we won't. Negative bucks, actually, by all forecasts. We have to invest in what's here in BC. We need to invest in regionalized renewable energy and community-owned energy, community-owned economies. And I think that's the dual energy shift or the dual power shift that we see. This is about, yes, improving people's lives with these better programs, but it's also about changing the fabric of our economy so people have a greater say, greater control over their economy and what it looks like. Because right now, it is controlled by these billionaires and mega corporations.
We now go to a local BC daycare where a couple is dropping off their kid for the first time.
This is a nice place.
Yeah.
I was a bit skeptical at first, but it's a good location, comes with a good subsidy, not going to cost a fortune.
Let's go in, let's ask the teacher some questions, take a look at the other kids, see what's going on.
Okay.
Let's take a look.
Welcome to our classroom. The kids are just having a little bit of free play time. Do you have any questions about the school or the class or what we're doing here?
No, we're pretty well briefed. Everybody here seems like their heart's in the right place, but
it's playtime, but what's happening over there? There's that child over there who's in the corner has accumulated 80% of the toys. What's going on?
That's little Jim Pattison. He's a rapscallion. He likes to collect as much as he can of the toys every playtime, but he throws a real hissy fit when you try to take anything back from him.
I think I see how this works. So he sits on all these toys that they originally came from the room, and then other kids come in and they see him and they think, okay, he just had all these toys. So, you know, they're young. They don't really have very good long-term memory.
Oh, I'm seeing a little closer. Jimmy has like these little stickers that say Jimmy Pattison, and he's sticking them on all the toys, on the little hospitals, on the little buses, on the billboards.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
He particularly seems to like the little billboard toys.
Yeah, all the billboards in the classroom are owned by Jimmy, and most of the wall space as well. So if you want to get any message out in the class, you got to go through him. Even I can't just put something up without running it by Jimmy first.
You let him take the blackboard?
Let is a strong word, but as you can see, there's a sticker on it. So yes, that is his as well.
Very persuasive child. Yeah.
Yeah.
Precocious.
Real go-getter.
Why is he eating a sandwich with peanut butter and lettuce? Clearly he's a frugal man, little boy.
Yeah, people do make that mistake often. He looks like an old man despite being a four-year-old.
I've heard of this condition. When people are born as elderly people, they just don't age at all, or they don't age backwards. They just stay the same age until they die.
Yeah, he hasn't aged backwards a day.
Okay, maybe Stefano can be a good influence on little Jimmy, and maybe they can be friends.
We can certainly give it a shot. Jim, he doesn't really take good influences. He's more taking things from the other children, the toys. That's more what he likes to take. The other kids, they didn't like it at first, and they still don't like it, but they have gotten used to it.
They just resign themselves to it.
Exactly, yeah. Your child will as well, I think. Little Shawnee, you've been in the classroom for a while now. How do you like it?
It's the way of nature. It's identical to gravity or math, biology, any study of the objective world. Jim has things already, and he can get more things. If anything, he's an inspiration to us. Obviously, an unreachable inspiration, but yeah, I would say I believe in the system fully. But I would like to have one toy one time, but...
Sometimes he lets the other kids play with the toys if they do things for him, do his chores at home or give him toys from home. He extracts basically whatever he can.
Yeah. Little Stefano, how would you like to rent your toys from little Jimmy? How does that sound?
You taught me that sharing was good and that these institutions were paid for with tax dollars.
He's been very pro-social, sharing with others and looking towards the common good. But I think it's time. It's never too early to beat that out of the child.
Sharing is nice, but we like to make kids ready for the real world in this kindergarten classroom, existing under the boot of the rich. And yeah, we find that children like that fall beneath Jim Pattison's mighty force of will and material acquisition quite quickly, actually.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of thing we reward. And honestly, I hope that kind of alpha attitude rubs off on Stefano.
I thought I was coming to class to learn and to have playtime with my friends, and we would just be able to come here and hang out and learn and be cared for.
The naivete of youth.
And now I'm coming into this shit show, and I don't really understand what's going on here.
It's somebody's first day.
You have a lot to learn from little Jimmy.
Hey, everyone, let's gang up on him.
Don't worry, little Stefano, we'll break you. We'll break that willful spirit of yours.
Where's that big, this big boot coming from?
Oh, that's the one that steps on all of our necks. It's part of nature.
Sorry, all of your necks except for Jimmy's.
Because Jimmy owns the boot.
Owns the boot, yeah.
His sticker's on it.
Oh my God, everyone, look. Jimmy's dad is here.
How's things going with the boy today?
Well, he accumulated even more of the toys through some real genius trades, leveraged what he already had, left some of the other children crying as usual.
I used to come in here, pick him up, and you'd give me all this rigmarole about how he wasn't sharing and
yes.
How this is a bad example and how you weren't being able to control the boy. And I would just always leave and be so proud of little Jimmy. I knew he'd totally own all the children here.
You were right, and he's even owned me as well. And now I'm under Jimmy's boot just like all of us, and Jimmy has some great boots.
It's a fine Italian leather boot. You know we flew out the cobbler. It was made over several fittings. His little foot, it's all wrinkled because he has this illness, as you're very aware of. But the boot fits splendidly.
Well, we have no problem here with the wrinkled foot at all. No, we all like it.
This seems to be a fine fit for little Stefano. Shall we, honey?
Yes, let's leave our poor child here to learn the real lessons of life.
All right, kids, now who wants to ask Jimmy if we can open up our picture books and read a story?
Please, Jimmy, please.
Is it true, Emily, that when you were considering running for leader, Sean Orr gassed you up about how it was a good idea?
Yeah. Like, honestly, at this point, I was already a candidate, but I think my confidence was wavering. I had just launched my campaign and I was so nervous. Everyone was talking about my age and I was being written off as like a token youth candidate. I was about to go to the first all candidates event and meet some of the older Green Base, meet the other candidates in person for the first time. Everything was moving so fast, so quickly. And I had a coffee with Sean. And yeah, he totally gassed me up, helped me see myself as a front runner when I really felt like the underdog in the pack. And so by August, we had effectively doubled the membership base of the party. We had numbers to show the pre-existing base that, hey, we have momentum. We're getting young people excited in a way that this party has never seen. And so, yeah, it was an important moment and important words of affirmation.
I gassed up Sean to make him run by transference.
Yeah, okay.
The so daisy chain.
2 degree separation there.
And if someone wants to try to convince me to run, I'm available for coffee.
Okay.
That's actually not me hinting that I want to run. I don't.
it's too late. It's not, you've sowed that seed.
Yeah. When I was looking over your leadership platform in advance of this, one of the things that stuck out to me was the advocacy for the 4-day work week. I think that's been around the Green Party sphere
ongoing.
For a while. Yeah,
yeah.
But it's really like...
Sonia Firstinot brought that in. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I really like Sonia too. Yeah. And yeah, it's the intersection between making people's lives better and addressing climate change. And it's framed in the terms of the fight that's going to be brought. And it's a global problem. But we also have this global solution forming at the same time. And like, I also feel like doing policy kind of stuff at the civic level, there's this interplay between these different jurisdictions. It's like in the Green Party UK, they pitch a policy and it's like, that's a great policy. You can use it here. So it's like we're pooling resources on the left right now because we have this shared momentum. Just so I feel really optimistic about the direction. On the subject of the oligarchs and the political control that they take over us, I feel like there's a connection here too with the direction that we've seen under the BCNAP. And for sort of our international non-local listeners, this is a progressive party and it was always mixed. There was always good critiques, but compared to what we have now, it looks like it was a golden age in retrospect under Horgan that we managed to tax the rich and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And right now we have these billionaires who step themselves into politics, try to shape the conversation. They fund documentaries that spread misinformation. They actively lie and misrepresent what's going on to people about things like harm reduction programs and DRIPA, things like that. We see this kind of backsliding on a bunch of things under the BCNDP, under David Eby. And it seems to me there's a direct connection between the political power of the rich, the advocacy of the rich, and also what we saw in the US with Elon Musk and Donald Trump and the funding of this big disinformation network. And then ironically, Trump becoming president again is used as like a justification here locally in a shock doctrine kind of way that we need to build out LNG to have our independence, et cetera. But then it's like American-owned firms and...
Yeah, it's maddening. It truly is. And yeah, if you aren't caught up on our soon-to-be U.S.-owned LNG industry here in B.C., basically this is an inheritance from the Christie Clark era, a conservative government a few cycles back. And we're now seeing, because of this Trump shock doctrine, a resurgence of these projects, zombie pipelines, effectively, coming back out of the woodwork. And these projects have received funding from equity firms that are snug in Trump's inner circle, Apollo Global Management and Blackstone, Steven Schwarzman. There are some real Wall Street ghouls in the mix here, and they're well covered in the Epstein files. Leon Black, just to name another. But yeah, and you know, when David Eby is asked directly about these US and Trump connections to these projects directly in DC, he said, whatever your political affiliation is, we welcome you here in BC. You might want to get the exact quote up, but I specifically said, we welcome you.
The exact quote is, when asked about ties to Donald Trump, Eby said, if you want to invest in BC, you want to build here, you want to create jobs here, we welcome you. Regardless of their affiliation, those investors can invest anywhere. They've decided to bring it here.
That says a lot to me, where we have a premier who isn't willing, even in this elbows up moment, to draw the line when it comes to actual US capital. He's only willing to do symbolic actions, pulling red state liquor from BC liquor store shelves, but he's not willing to actually stand up for BC's resource economy and ensure that we have an economy that is controlled by our own interests.
They have a DEI policy that warmly welcomes the oligarchs.
Yes.
On the subject of Eby, what happened to the supply and confidence agreement that was originally negotiated? Yeah, giving some context again for people not super plugged in, is that Eby had a minority government as part of becoming premier. There was the previous leader of the Green Party, there was a negotiated deal to advance some climate priorities. And at some point that deal fell apart.
So basically after the 2024 election, were razor-thin majority government by one seat. And the NDP came to us and said, if we agree to have some confidence on some votes, the NDP will execute an agreed-upon program, delivering on affordability, on community housing, on community healthcare centers, and also disability issues like the spousal clawbacks.
I just want to explain what that is, which is that if you're on disability and it's like you live with a partner, they pull some of your money away because your family income is bigger, something like that?
Yeah, effectively. And evil absurd policy. And evil, evil. And we still have more to go on that. But basically, we got to the end of the year. We said, okay, where did we get? We had all these policies and programs that we agreed to for the first year. And the NDP did not deliver on 2/3 of what they promised in the year one of the cooperation agreement. So that's not a foundation of trust to move forward on. And we pitched them on some new priorities, some new programs for year two, like strengthening union rights, like a wealth tax, social housing at scale, and they flatly refused. And like, this is what inspires even a little bit of nostalgia for the John Horgan years, is that program that we set out for our year two negotiation. I think Horgan, a previous NDP government, would have gladly embraced what we put forward. But yeah, EB's NDP was just, yeah, staunchly opposed. And so we went our separate ways.
Yeah. What's your relationship like, David EB? Like, do you guys ever kick it or like...
We used to meet monthly back in the day of the cooperation agreement. So that was the first 5 months of my time as leader. Now, I mean, yeah, we have relationships with the NDP caucus. We talk to their ministers. We talk to Nikki Sharma. David and I have a cooling off period, and I think it's just as well.
Because EB coming in, I thought a lot of people had this impression that EB was one of the good ones, a mixed group at the BCNDP, but EB's probably going to do good stuff. I've been really surprised. I was surprised at first. I'm no longer surprised. First was like the involuntary care thing of like really hammering this idea that in order to deal with the drug overdose crisis and street homelessness, that there needs to be an involuntary care programs where people are given drug treatment against their will. Yeah. How does that land in the Green Party world?
Yeah. So we oppose that. And what we've seen with the BCNDP is they are just using involuntary care as a bizarre, costly, and ineffective way of addressing our opioid overdose crisis and homelessness and all the systemic issues involved there. They would rather criminalize people, force them into institutions on the site of prisons. Those are where the new involuntary care centers are built. Than actually provide the wraparound supports that we need to see, rather than providing the kind of free and accessible housing that we need and, you know, expansion of safe consumption and long-term care beds and, yeah, all those sort of ground-based supports that are needed. They are choosing to, again, keel to far-right fear-mongering, conservative fear-mongering about street disorder and, yeah, what's happening in communities across BC, slap a Band-Aid solution on it. And I think we're already seeing just how ineffective that is. The BC Greens have formed our policy on involuntary care around some really brilliant research that shows this doesn't work. You just get people cycling in and out of involuntary care.
And isn't it also true that there's not enough voluntary care? Like if someone wants to get drug treatment, that they have a 5 or 6 month or 8 month waiting list for stuff like that at the same time?
Thanks for teeing me up on that. That's a great point. That's exactly right. Is the BC Greens are advocating for voluntary care, getting rid of these wait lists, these delays, but the BCNDP are just, again, crumbling to pressure and expanding involuntary care as a way to just posture as being tough on crime. Frankly, I think that's part of the ideological approach here. Just another way to court center-right voters, which is what they've done consistently across this year. It was one of the earliest things that they did after the 2024 election. So yeah, I think it's just yet another example of political cowardice.
It feels so mean-spirited. You would at least want to max out. Anyone who wants care can get it before you start thinking about, oh, do we need to force people into
it? You think.
Yeah, court these mean-spirited voters or this idea of, oh, we got to get these people off the streets. But the people who think like that aren't in favor of the BC NDP anyway. It's not like they won those voters over. They're just like, I still don't like David Eby. He only did this because he had to. Or like, you don't win any of those people by doing stuff like this.
Secretly woke Eby is just lying to us as he's rolling out the erosion of our property rights and so on. It doesn't even make sense from like a strategic perspective. It's like this playbook that's built on an information infrastructure of the 1980s and 90s where everything is broadcast through TV and you have to get it past like the rich guys who own the TV station to have your message out. But like people who vote for the NDP go on the internet and they're able to see different perspectives and stuff. So just on a strategic level, taking all the morality out of it, which like I have a huge problem with the viciousness of that policy, that they're trying to appeal to people's sense of not only should people get treatment, but I kind of want to imagine they're going to be dragged off somehow. That's what they're like playing to there. There's something sick about that. But even on a straightforward, pragmatic, strategic, anything goes in the service of power front, it's not even working on that front. So then it's just like cowardice and, dare I say, stupidity together.
I agree.
Yeah, and so they recriminalized drug use and they dropped the decriminalization pilot partway through the pilot, responding to this fear-mongering that was funded literally by billionaires and disinformation networks. And you can trace specifically where the money comes in at Pacific Prosperity Foundation, I think is one of them. Mm-hmm. Chip Wilson's outfit, the Vancouver is Dying documentary was the lie-filled fake documentary created to get people riled up. What were there issues with decriminalization that were worth addressing? Is that totally fake? What should have been done instead?
Yeah, so I think my issue with David Eby is that he sure will try progressive policies, but he designs them to fail. We weren't necessarily in a place to just launch this decriminalization pilot without the wraparound supports in place. They were just marching forward with this without this systemic view and without the proper funding, without the proper timeline. They just pulled the plug when the going got tough, when the headlines were too much for them to stand behind. But when I talk to so many harm reduction advocates, it's so often the case that there are, particularly in the beginning, this more challenging period of transition, but they just went through all the hard stuff and didn't reap any of the rewards because they pulled the plug. This kind of program requires longevity and it requires proper funding and these wraparound supports. And so it, in my view, was designed to fail, much like EB set up a proportional representation in 2017, not to pivot. But I think this is the pattern of this government is designing progressive policies to fail and really crumbling to far-right fear-mongering and pressure. And so this was the case with pro-rep. EB designed the questions. He set out five options, a few of which had never been practiced anywhere in the world. So you have this list of confusing options and then, no, let's keep things the same. What are people going to choose? And mind you, it narrowly failed despite all of that obstruction.
I happen to know about that. So on a personal level, that referendum, I watched the results come in with some NDP people, and that was like the moment I was like done with it. I was like not happy with the ballot. It was clearly fucked up in that way of just being like not simple. And they promised the campaign in favor of it, and they like did, but it was like pretty half-assed. And I, because I worked in getting that government elected as a voter contact organizer in a swing riding, I had spoken to a bunch of NDP MLAs where I was advocating to them for proportional representation. Like they didn't, and this is in the context of the referendum coming up, and they've been briefed internally that if this passes, you might lose your seat. It changes things so much that we can't hold on to power. So this is what's being ricocheted to me through literal MLAs that they've been briefed internally that basically we're not really in favor of it. And I'm like, no, it's good. You guys could win still. Like it's gonna be good. Like it's like I'm talking to someone who's a very important person with a six-figure salary, and I'm some schmuck, but they don't actually know like what proportional representation is, what the arguments for it are or anything. And they're like in government. And the briefing that they got as part of quote unquote campaigning in favor wasn't making the case for proportional representation. It was fear mongering about how their districts might change and how it might affect their ability to be reelected. So that is a little insight. I've never shared that anywhere. That's true. 100% true.
Anyone who gets to power, once they're there in the central office, they just desperately want to cling on to that. And proportional rep is just about handing it off.
It's about cooperation.
Yeah.
It's about representing the popular choice and taking the boot off people's necks where they feel like they're forced to choose between lesser of two evils. And that's why 44% of people didn't vote in the last election, because they feel stuck between a rock and a hard place and uninspired. And so I think they were reckoning with this would force them to work harder. This would be in excess of democracy, maybe, for David Eby. In my view and in my assessment of what pro-rep would mean today, it would mean the BC Greens holding court, holding the BC NDP to account, and the two parties governing for pretty much forever. We would lock out the Conservatives by current assessments. And so it's pretty ridiculous to hear these old fear-mongering arguments. And this does look like, a far more democratic way of sharing power and governing.
It mirrors the federal situation as well. Centrist parties who are accustomed to being the natural ruling party, they just can't see a world where they have to share or really cooperate. They just see a world where they try to get majorities forever and ever in perpetuity and would rather hand off power to the right for maybe one or two or maximum of three terms than come back and take over
decades.
Then lock them out forever, which would be the case federally too if the Liberals would have actually run a good faith referendum on proportional representation, which was promised, and instead we got postcards.
Yeah, that one really pisses me off. This all pisses me off, but that pisses me off in a really like wonky nerd way that is close to my heart. But also, do you believe in democracy or not? But the answer is unfortunately no. Yeah, because of the sickness of power. Like power is a sickness-inducing kind of thing, and people are afraid of not being reelected and getting reelected enough times to get their pension, which is it's just interesting. You get reelected enough times, you just get money forever from the government.
Twice.
Yeah.
That's it. Only twice.
Yeah.
I think
you just have to do two terms, whatever the length.
Then you get a full pension.
Yeah.
And I think federally it's based on years, because I remember there's this big argument around Jagmeet not taking down the federal government because they were like, oh, he gets his pension after this time or whatever. And that was like the right wing attack.
Great incentives. What if everyone got pensions regardless of what they did for work forever? And then you'd remove that incentive entirely.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Everyone should get that.
Papa and boy.
Papa, have you seen the latest news on Twitter? I mean, X? It looks like private property rights are over in BC.
What are you talking about, boy? I don't believe we've elected any sort of transitionary government trying to move away from private property rights. What are you talking about?
Well, according to what I read, communist premier David Eby and the BC NDP passed something called DRIPA, which has to do with land acknowledgements, where they say that British Columbia is on unceded territory and now they're going to give all the land to Indigenous people.
Oh, no, boy. DRIPA doesn't do that. That's not correct information that you were reading there on X. That's just not true. If DRIPA doesn't really like even do enough. It is true that BC is unceded territory. There weren't treaties done with Indigenous nations here at the time of settlement and colonization. That's just a factual truth. DRIPA is the BC implementation of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a federal report and investigation on the history of anti-Indigenous racism and colonialism, gave 94 calls to action. One of those 94 calls to action was to implement UN DRIP, the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, which is it's like 48 clauses. And basically the main premise of it is that Indigenous people have human rights. It relates to an acknowledgement of the history of colonization. It just, one of the things that it does is say that the government needs to consult with Indigenous nations when it relates to things that happen on Indigenous territories.
I don't know. I saw people posting that they'd received some letter, people in Richmond, that their homes might be taken away or something like that.
Boy, that's the Cowichan decision. That has nothing to do with DRIPA. That's a BC Supreme Court case, which is based on Section 35 of the Canadian Constitution. The BC Supreme Court ruled that Cowichan Nation proved Aboriginal title over 800 acres of government land, but they explicitly said the ruling would not displace private property owners who had purchase this in good faith, and that their property is not going to be taken away. That's explicitly in the Cowichan ruling. And the Cowichan ruling is not related to DRIPA. It was filed in 2014. DRIPA was voted on in 2019, and it was unanimous in the entire legislature, even the conservatives in the legislature, which at that time, I don't know if you know your BC history, they were called the BC Liberals then. The Conservative Party in BC used to be called the BC Liberals.
Yeah,
I know.
Weird.
But it was a unanimous vote. And the Cowichan case doesn't relate to DRIPA. What relates to DRIPA is the Gitkala case at the end of 2025, which was just ruling that Indigenous nations have a right to be consulted on mining that is done on their lands in particular. It doesn't relate to the holding of real estate or private property. It relates to mineral use in particular.
Okay. Well, that's good. I was worried that private property...
It's not good or bad. It's just facts.
No, I'm a child and I don't own any property in BC yet, but I do hope to be a future property owner. So I was worried that property rights were over in BC, but I guess not.
What you're reading there is a conscious and intentional strategy of misinformation that's a coalition between the far right and far right racists and industry. And like, I think it says it all, the Gitkalan case is about industry's right to exploit mineral resources without consultation. They understand that by drumming up fear about Indigenous people coming for your trying to come for your home in the suburbs, that they can turn people against enshrining human rights for Indigenous people. And they've intentionally done that. And since this whole misinformation thing has started, the percentage of the population in BC that say that DRIPA goes too far went from, I think, 40% to 53%. And then the provincial government that enshrined DRIPA, that brought DRIPA in with unanimous consent across all parties, sees the polling, oh, 53%. Goodness, I'm so afraid I need to have 50% in order to win elections. And instead of doing the work of explaining and educating and leading on this issue and the meaningfulness of working to have reconciliation with Indigenous nations and people who have been displaced, criminalized, and stolen from for over 100 years, they're just bending over and in fact actually validating these false claims from far-right racists for the benefit of industry.
Yeah, when I saw Premier David Eby saying he was going to repeal parts of DRIPA, I thought, wow, there must really be a problem with this thing. You know, if the premier, the head of the party who passed it, needs to repeal it this quickly afterwards, really makes it seem like it must be bad. But yeah, that's crazy. What a weird and cowardly move.
There's a systemic problem, boy, about the political power of the super rich and industry and a revolving door between public service and private lobbying. Former Premier John Horgan, may he rest in peace, joined the board of Teck Resources, the biggest coal mining company in Canada, after leaving office. And former NDP Premier Glenn Clark did the same thing in the 90s. Former NDP Energy and Mines Minister Michelle Mongal now works as a mining industry lobbyist. According to the Dogwood Initiative, at least 136 people who formerly held office in the provincial government have become paid lobbyists, and they use their knowledge of how government works to help private corporations make more money. The CEO of the Association for Mineral Exploration at its annual conference said, talking about the provincial government of David Eby, "We have not seen an alignment of support for getting minerals and rare metals out of the ground faster than we're seeing right now." And since Eby has been backtracking and going back and forth on DRIPA, chasing polls, instead of doing the work of leading, he's damaged relationships with the First Nations in BC. He's undermined trust. It's seen as a fundamental betrayal, and he's playing into disinformation, which is being advanced by industry, using far-right proxies and appealing to racist paranoia and fears to advance their agenda of mineral and gas exploration. That's what's going on here.
Thank you for explaining that to me, Papa. Maybe I shouldn't get all my news from X, the Everything app.
Look, boy, look up the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous people, read the 48 clauses and tell me which ones you disagree with. It's obviously the right thing to do. It's obviously deeply morally grounded in the history of colonialism and displacement in this country. Like, it used to be that Indigenous people living on reserve were policed to not be able to leave the reserve without permission. It used to be that it was illegal for Indigenous people to hire lawyers to stake land claims without permission from the government. And another thing you should read is the Truth and Reconciliation Report. It will make you cry your eyes out. It is unbelievable what happened in this country. It is unbelievable what this country did to Indigenous people who lived in and tended to these lands. It is genuinely repulsive and horrifying. There's a reason we're in this situation, and it's not DRIPA. The reason we're in this situation is because Canada was founded on genocide. And I'm not blaming you, boy. Just to be clear, I'm not blaming you. I know you're just a boy. You were just born into this world. You inherited the situation. Just the same as me. I didn't do this. But we need to take responsibility for the situation that we've inherited. We need to do the right thing for all people, but especially people who are victims of genocide, especially people who are victims of the genocide of our government, with Indigenous people being treated as second-class citizens in Canada, statistically way more likely to live in poverty, statistically way more likely to be deprived of political voice. And I worry that the capitulation to these far-right narratives, the lack of work being done to help connect the dots for people, it's inciting racism. It's inciting even violence against Indigenous people. We have to take responsibility. We have to take our part in healing this wound. It's not just a wound on Indigenous communities. It's a wound on our society. You'll have to forgive me, boy. I can get worked up about this stuff, but it's repulsive to capitulate to this kind of stuff. We need to stand up for what's right. That's how I feel.
Papa and boy!
We now go to the BC Premier's office.
David Eby, sir, the right wing is saying something factually incorrect and borderline libelous, and they've totally convinced a major fraction of the population that will never ever vote for you that it's correct. What do we do?
Get out. I need to go to my mind palace. Liberty, property rights, Indigenous title, UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, Tax Convoy, 1692, Tillamook versus British Columbia, 1997. Tech Mining Corporation, 47 seats, 44.86% campaign bus, Richmond, safe injection sites, BC Real Estate Association, Lunchip, 16 long years, climate activists disqualified, international students, unlocking supply, doing our level best, elbows up, land acknowledgement, daylight savings time, Dallas Brody, Point Grey homeowners. I've made my decision. Bring out Old Faithful.
Sir? You mean the big red button labeled capitulate entirely? You've been pressing it a lot, sir. I'm worried the spring is going to give out.
Now who's the goddamn premier here? Bring me the big red button.
Yes, sir. Of course, sir. I'm sorry.
It's a test of leadership. And I'll just press the button. Perfect. So yeah, talking about this repeated capitulations and cowardice of Eby's administration entering, now it looks like there was potentially going to be a DRIPA election, but that got peeled back because of a caucus revolt or something. Mm-hmm. So not clear when the next election is going to be, but I'm curious how you see the strategy for the BC Green Party as a third party in a first past the post system where like mm-hmm. vote splitting is always the narrative instead of talking about policy and
fear-mongering. Yeah.
But then also, yeah, recent polls show that there's a lot of growing support in Metro Vancouver and mm-hmm. other places in the province. You have a sense of strategy of towards governance or towards influence in governance?
Yeah. So I think for the next election, whenever that may be, we are going to just be laser focused on our top 10 ridings where we have the most momentum. And I think that helps punch through some of that vote splitting narrative as well, and that we are focusing all of our electoral resources on areas where we could prevent a conservative from being elected, for instance, and have a real chance of electoral success. And I think it'll be interesting to see the results of that election, but my goal is to firmly hold the balance of power. That may look like tripling our seat count with six or more seats, holding that balance. And I think when we get into the negotiating room for the cooperation agreement, we'll have a lot more leverage than we did back in 2024. Back in that agreement, we saw some great early momentum, but then the NDP just felt like they didn't need us. And then the entire rest of the year was just like pushing a boulder up the hill, trying to get them to do anything. And so that's why we landed with 2/3 of that agreement not complete. For the next time around, I will be singularly focused on bringing in proportional representation. I don't want it to go to a referendum or another vote. We'll just bring it in and maybe check in a few election cycles, see how it's going. But yeah, that would be my primary focus, unlike or very similar to Avi Lewis's approach federally, if you were to hold the balance of power.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me, just mentioning Avi, I feel like really right now is the first time in my entire life that I've had something positive to vote for at all three levels of government. This is the first time I've actually liked the NDP in like a while with Avi, and like I feel a lot of momentum there. And then with the BC Greens, I feel really good about the policy and platform and stuff. And that strategy makes a lot of sense to me. And then at the civic level, we got a good party. Mm-hmm. It's never happened before in my life. Like, usually it's all ass, all it's all ass all the way down. It's kind of awesome in Vancouver right now.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Because just to finish the outcome, if we had pro rep, if the BC Greens continue, as trends predict, polling over above 20% of the popular vote, we would hold effectively 20% of the seats in the legislature. So that would be transformative for our ability to govern and hold the governing party to account and to share that power equally and to more fully represent BC.
Also, maybe side benefit, since the NDP caucus is fairly divided, maybe it would embolden some of the more progressive to align more with the populist left agenda.
Across the floor? I don't know.
Or even cross the floor. Yeah,
because I think increasingly EB has a fractured coalition in his own caucus even. And I'm not totally clear what their strategy will be in the next election. I almost hope that our heat from the left at least motivates them to put out some leftist policies and court the left, and we can duke it out that way. But I also think it's interesting to look at what's happening in the UK under Zach Polanski. They're pulling ahead of Labour now, their Labour Party, which is very similarly status quo, center-right, liberal approach. And Zach's line has been, we're here to actually replace Labour. They don't see a path forward necessarily for the Labour Party in the UK. And honestly, I think if the NDP has a leadership race before the next election, the people next in line are going to be similarly center-right, very likely, and within the establishment of the party. So I think there is a world in which the BC Greens strongly become the new Workers' Party and in a few election cycle potentially form government.
It does seem actually a genuine possibility to me that EB could burn whatever capital he has. Like, I was thinking earlier, like, you're going to be leader of the Greens longer than he's going to be leader of the NDP for sure.
Seems that way.
But then, even if he holds it together, like, you know, you're in a position where you're going up and you're building confidence over time, but he's coming from like super majority territory to like on the edge and selling out all these values. It's like only so many cycles you can do that before the backroom boys shuffle you out and get the next person in to get a fresh face, smiling and generic. It only occurred to me for the first time in this conversation, you're probably actually there to stay and he's probably not.
Yeah, no, I'm here to stay. And that's for sure. And yeah, it does increasingly, especially with how egregiously he's mishandled the DRIPA conversation, how he's misinformed the public and has completely crumbled to pressure, has refused to stand for Indigenous rights and debunk the ridiculousness, the right-wing claim that there's any threat to private property. And so, yeah, I think his tenure as leader has an expiry date on it. I don't know what that date is, but it's clear that there's momentum to move him out.
Yeah.
Which in some ways is right now, EB is opening up a whole lot of ground for the Greens to push the NDP on and build power and support with their traditional base and youth and non-voters and people who are even disillusioned from the right. So I think that doesn't go away, but I am worried about an NDP leadership race that slaps a new face on the same policies and is just further misleads people about what the core of their party is and stands for. And I hope that they have a real come to Jesus moment and become far more progressive than they have been for the last several years. But yeah, I'm skeptical after studying pretty closely how corporate captured this government is and the extent of lobbying and vested interests.
When we have Premier Loughan next year or a couple years down the line, whatever, how can the provincial government transform this province for working people to take on the political power of the super rich and corporate capture and deliver a society with a more caring economy that takes care of people, takes real action on climate? What does that look like?
This is a beautiful question. I think we're so used to government not delivering quality services for people, not used to expanding public programs, things like fast free transit, building social housing quickly at scale, and having things like universal childcare. And I think we need to be crystal clear about what we're up against. We're up against an extreme concentration of wealth. BC has the highest rate of wealth inequality in Canada, the fastest growing rate. And as we've seen to the south of us, a rising rate like that plunges us into really terrifying conditions for our economy and for our democracy. And so what I'm proposing is a one-time 10% tax on wealth that is over $100 million. That would shore up, in that 1 year alone, $13 billion to pay for things like universal childcare. So these are the kind of solutions that we're looking at. But obviously, that is just one on the surface, because we have had decades where our tax system has been hollowed out by conservative premiers and has rigged our economy to give free rides to the mega corporations, whether that's our royalty regime or other wonky policy things that I won't get too much into. But yeah, when I'm premier, I hope it's like a culture shock, right? Because people aren't used to the government working for them. They're not used to the government reining in these corporations and actually picking a fight and standing up to big business interests, because I think people are so used to seeing the ultra wealthy and the private sector meld in the fabric of government and all three actors working in coordination to screw over working people. I think that's the lived reality that people feel, and they feel like they're out here on their own. And so I hope that we can strongly reverse those trends. And I think part of the imagination part of this is so exciting. And when I was touring the province for 2 months, this is something that came up a lot when I was in communities like on Gixan territories in Sikkadak, which is a community that has reclaimed a portion of their territories and has built a ring of affordable social housing enclosed with their nation band office, a community health center, and has built an amazing farm and that has like year-round produce and a place where local hunters can butcher their game and everything. And it's projects like that that are investing in the well-being of community, that is creating sustained long-term jobs for youth and people across the community, that really inspire me and offer a sense of sovereignty and autonomy that you just don't see in, yeah, the dominant economy that we have now, which is controlled by billionaires and mega corporations. There's a similar story in Prince George, where amazingly, unions are starting to coalesce around a vision for sustainable forestry, which is basically investing in jobs in an industry that is like high value added, diversified, and more sustainable that requires a whole lot more labor, because we're starting to realize that these billionaire-controlled industries are trying to innovate, legislate our workers out of existence, whether it's AI or efficiency upgrades. And often in the case with Canfor in Prince George, the minute that the profit winds shift, they just pick up shop and leave thousands of workers in the lurch. They relocated to the southeast of the US. I think that is part of the sickness of our economy in BC, is we're right now held hostage by these foreign multinationals that dominate our resource economy, and we need to diversify away from that. But I think the beautiful vision is that it's far more community-controlled industries across renewables, across the care economy, investing in people to retrain as teachers and care workers, and different kind of new industries in manufacturing and in innovation. So I'm very excited for what the future holds. And it does feel like we're in this purgatory where the BC NDP has this guise of shallow progressive values, but we still see them supporting an economy that is rigged for the ultra wealthy, that's rigged for these massive resource corporations. And yeah, is refusing to entertain a bolder idea, a bolder vision for the future.
It's just absurd and pretty funny. We have leadership here that says that we live in a wealthy province, that we live in an extremely well-trained and innovative province, but they just keep doubling down on extractive industry. These aren't innovative industries. And you see, what are they touting as innovative startups that, I don't know, make gluten-free matcha lattes for dogs? This is not innovation. This is insanity. Where's BC's real industry innovation here? Where's the value added? Where's the brain power?
I think people are starting to pick up on the reality of a profit-obsessed, capitalist, extractive economy. And they're like, why is it that we can build hundreds of AI data centers in a flash, flouting all regulations and community concerns, and it takes years and years and years to build things like trains and rapid transit and the kind of infrastructure that actually serves community? And obviously, we know that it's because we live in a system that puts profit over people at every turn. But yeah, I think we're seeing a broader public awakening about just how like ridiculous and unimaginative that vision is.
I think people are coming around. Finally, we're starting to see the tattered edges of these myths that perpetuate the status quo come apart, especially with the watershed moment of the Epstein files and people just taking lifting the veil and seeing that these people are not the innovators. They're not the titans of industry. They're just not that interesting or smart or dynamic. They spend their time trying to just hold on to the wealth that they've amassed, like it's a shrinking pile of sugar in the rain. They email about refinancing their yachts or their jets, how to avoid taxes. They're not concerned with the big problems. They just want to appear that way on the outside. And the emails are amazing for that. And people that have dug into that and reported on that have shown that these are the conversations that are actually happening between these luminaries. And I think people wisen up and be like, do I really want someone like Musk or Zuckerberg taking tens of millions of dollars to just play around with their whims and try things out that flop and create and destroy value in seconds? $46 million flop for the metaverse, for example. It's just, there are a lot of smart people that should have a stake in this. And if we actually had a democratic society, maybe we'd actually be making decisions collectively that actually did things right.
Yeah. And I think the perfect example there is Jim Pattison. Again, he attained that wealth purely through acquisition, buying and selling and creating a larger conglomerate industry and creating monopolies on our media in BC and on other natural resources. And that kind of imbalance in power and that kind of reward for people who are doing the pretty simple administration of acquisition is just such a uninspiring way to arrange our economy.
What would be a more inspiring way to rearrange it?
I think everyone wants to feel like they did something with their day, that they have a sense of purpose and that they're contributing in a tangible and meaningful way. And so many of us are forced to do bullshit jobs where we're separated from any sense of personal value or meaning and contribution. And I think there's so much that can be done to expand community work and to rearrange our economy so we're not so focused on rip it and ship it resource extraction, but we actually give the reins to workers more instead of these foreign multinationals and offer people the opportunity to define what an innovative and sustainable economy looks like. Guys like Edison Motors, who after waiting for 5 years for a Tesla semi-truck, electric truck to arrive that never came, they decided to just make their own in their parents' backyard in the interior of BC, didn't have a huge background in electrical engineering or manufacturing, but they were trucking guys. They were part of the industry. And now they're producing the first hybrid electric shipping trucks in all of Western, in all of Canada, I'm pretty sure. That's the kind of thing that I want to see more of in BC, is people having the resources to innovate, to do things that fill real needs in our province and aren't just a part of this corporate-dominated AI slop metaverse. People who are really focused on, democratizing our control over economy and having, greater well-being.
This has been a fun conversation. I'm glad to have you both here today and chat about all these things. Anything, I don't know, any last comments or thoughts that we want to throw on the mix to get people riled up for the future of a transition to an ecological and democratic society that pays people according to need and organizes the distribution of things based on care, like an enormous lending library with reduced work hours and freedom for all?
Yeah, all of those things and more. I think it's really easy to feel depressed in moments like this in the history of the world. And I think, weirdly, I'm grappling with the contradiction of that, because I have never felt more hopeful about the possibility of this movement and transformative outcomes in this province. And so I'm just a one-person focus group on that despite the horrors that surround us, I feel like we're living through the death rattle of the old world, and we're starting to coalesce and gather real steam to punch through with the alternatives that we need and build up this new reality that is caring and centered on well-being and ecology and the rights of people and not the ruling class. So it's an exciting time, and it's going to be a tough road, and I'll need everyone here investing in this experiment, in this process. And I'm so excited for what's next.
It'll be a long road to libertarian municipalism and library socialism, but in the meantime, we could have a little bit of a surfeit of democracy, maybe, where we could have PR.
Representation.
Maybe we'll get basic income or basic services, take the boot off the neck a bit. Mm-hmm. People have more time to think, do some reading, maybe get more political. And then maybe a couple of generations later, we'll be going to meetings. And we'll be making decisions.
A few generations later. I think that's actually totally a part of my long-term vision, is shoring up the programs that we need to take the boot off the neck so people can start investing in their own community, starting to make collective decisions around what their future economy looks like. And there's obviously a whole lot of things that we need to do at the provincial and national level to make that possible, to get these corporate actors out of the mix. But that is the 50-year vision, is like having that kind of radical municipalism where people are deeply invested in the place that they live, and we're able to share resources across municipalities and have a much more decentralized way of organizing our economy and society.
There you have it. Emily Lowen and the BC Green Party, they're going to be going to war with the stepping on necks boot industry, damaging all those jobs, all those hardworking Joes having to work in traffic. They're not going to...
Making the boots, wearing the boots.
Stepping on the necks, and the Jills as well. Yeah, the hardworking Jills. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Fight the oligarchs.
And if you live in BC, join, donate, etc. Vote. Be part of a tip of a spear to make sure that every single seat is won. Do it, people in BC. Okay, bye. And I'll just pop out this interview tape. Well, hey, that was fun talking to Emily Lowen and Daniel.
Really makes you feel hopeful hearing politicians saying things that I really agree with.
Yeah, that's the first party leader of many, I might add, to come on the Seriously Wrong podcast. And the first party leader who indicated to us privately that she listens to the show. And not out of, I think, not merely out of preparation, but because the values alignment is obvious.
She was just spitting fire this entire interview. I've been editing it since we recorded it, and I just keep having the thought, like, man, she's really spitting a lot of fire here.
Should we rename it to the BC Red, Orange, and Yellow Party, which is the color of fire in cartoons? Just spitballing, obviously. I'm not an expert on whether that would be a good branding decision.
Yeah, I just started thinking about, as an ecological metaphor, whether spitting fire is like a really good, like maybe it should be, it's definitely not a machine metaphor. It is organic.
She's dropping seeds. She's dropping organic local seeds.
Yeah, seeds that are plump and juicy and ready to sprout.
Yeah. She tells it like it is. Common sense.
So yeah, looking forward to seeing how the BC Greens are able to move the needle on stuff in BC in the near future, maybe proportional representation.
And also, what after, as a listener, you can rest assured that once we have Premier Lowen, we will be lobbying very hard to create a new ministry in BC called the Ministry of Things That Have Been Talked About on Seriously Wrong, to focus on a lot of our core priorities and our legislative agenda at the provincial level. So that's something you can look forward to.
Yeah.
That lobbying, if not the ministry itself, but...
Yeah, we can't guarantee the ministry coming into effect, but we can guarantee the lobbying will happen. And we can't guarantee it will be named that, but we can guarantee that if it does happen, it will do that.
I agree. 100% agree.
Yeah, if you live in BC, join the BC Greens. Vote for the BC Greens if it's applicable. If you don't live in BC, if you live in the world, take heart. Look at this example of something good happening and be like, damn, that's cool. Maybe something like that can happen here too. And maybe it can.
Yeah, it is. There's a global thing happening. It's an inspiring moment to have things and people to vote for that aren't ghoulish turds. I know that's not high praise in itself. I've got separate high praise for Emily Lowen, but non-ghoulish turd leadership is something that I think we've all been very hungry
starving
for.
Starving for it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We've been choking down these ghoulish turds for too long.
If you like what we do as a podcast and you want to keep the lights on at the old podcast factory, keep the fridge stocked, then head on over to our Patreon and, you know, help us out a little bit. Help yourself to some bonus episodes and help us continue making this little show.
Something that we can give a full commitment to is that people who sign up for that Sweet Six, they get their coveted beautiful genius status. Anyone who donates to the show is a beautiful genius. That contribution will get you access to those bonus episodes, support great independent leftist content, not naming any names, but it is great. And it also we'll use the majority of that funds to meet our basic biological needs, such as eating food, a place to sleep at night that's not cold. I also have children. I've got two children. Their biological needs are also reinforced by this. So basically anyone who doesn't give to the show is basically starving a child. And I know no one wants to be part of that. And I guess our closing message here is do the right thing and mosey on down, bicycle on over, thinking greenly, to the Seriously Wrong Patreon and contribute. It makes a big difference, makes us feel fuzzy inside, and we appreciate it so deeply. And everyone who's already doing that, thank you so much. And you are beautiful and you are a genius. And everyone who's thinking about that, you are also a beautiful genius, potentially. So
moseying, I think, is actually greener than a bike. I got caught up on correcting from moseying to biking as more green. I think technically the other way around. Not to shit on bikes, but you got to produce a bike.
That's small detail. That's egg on my face.
Sorry.
Because you're absolutely right that humankind has been moseying since time immemorial. It's part of what makes it's healthy. A daily mosey keeps the doctor away.
Yeah.
So you can hit multiple birds with one stone, or as I prefer to use the metaphor, you can feed medicine to multiple sick birds with one medicine, because you shouldn't be stoning birds.
You can cure many birds with one bird medicine supply.
And if any of you throw a rock at a fucking bird, I'm going to be pissed. Don't do that.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
See y'all next week.